The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org. My guest today is Devin Reeves. He's the executive director of the Pennsylvania Harm Reduction Coalition. They do a lot of great work, and it is a real honor to have him on the show today. We'll hear that interview in a moment. But first, Kerwin Kay is an associate professor of sociology, American studies, and feminist, gender, and sexuality studies at Wesleyan University. Professor Kay is the author of a new book published by Columbia University Press entitled Enforcing Freedom, Drug Courts, Therapeutic Communities, and the Intimacies of the State. We had the first part of my conversation with Professor Kay on last week's program. Now, as promised, here's more. Professor, in your book, you write, quote, "Drug courts and other criminal justice-oriented treatment programs not simply work to get individuals to stop using drugs. Rather, they focus their attention on changing what case managers and social workers often frame as an entire, quote, drugs lifestyle, end quote." And I suppose, there you go. Doesn't matter that they don't really use drugs or have a drug use disorder. They have a drug lifestyle, and so that has to be fixed. Unpack that. That sounds really bad.
Well, so the case managers spoke about a drugs lifestyle. At the treatment center themselves, the managers there, the social workers there, sometimes would speak of dope fiend behaviors, but they were referring to the same thing. And what they mean by drugs lifestyle is, you know, has nothing to do, for example, with the type of drug use that might be on Wall Street, where some people are doing a lot of cocaine or a lot of whatever drug and using that as part of their work, using that to play after work. That's not the drugs lifestyle. So what the drugs lifestyle is it pertains to what I felt that it was that it pertains to basically what's happening on street life. As part of the hustling that you have to do in order to survive when you are unemployed or sporadically employed in the formal economy. And so what the counselors talk about is things like a lack of responsibility, an inability to defer gratification, things that have, responding to all challenges that might be made with sort of angry, violent returns, not obeying authority, having distrust of authority. That's the drugs lifestyle. And actually, these things are adaptive for life on the street, for the hustling type of lifestyle that you have to do in order to protect yourself, in order to maintain a reputation, in order to take advantage of situations that might arise on the moment, be very improvisational, in order to certainly not obey whatever rules are there if you can get around them. So those are the types of things that they're trying to treat, using drug treatment as the form of that. So, you know, like I began this research, one of the questions I asked is, how do they know people are getting better when no one is actively doing drugs at that moment? They're all in these residential treatment centers. They're doing drug tests all the time for the people who are on outpatient. And so, how do they know that people are getting better? And, you know, how do they operationalize this idea of addiction? And basically, it has to do with accepting orders, doing what you're told, doing a lot of boring activities like, you know, a lot of chores, a lot of cleaning up, a lot of that type of low-level work, being yelled at a lot by the counselors at the drug treatment. You just have to get yelled at a lot in order to get better off of drugs, according to the treatment, the way the treatment is often done. So there's a lot of yelling by the staff at people to obey the orders, and you're specifically not allowed to yell back. You know, you have to take it. You have to learn how to take these sort of insults to your person and not respond in kind and not respond by yelling and going flying off the handle. So to my mind, what they were doing was that they were more or less preparing people for entry into low-wage labor, where a lot of the jobs really are horrendous, and your boss might be yelling at you, and you have to follow these stupid bureaucratic rules that make no sense, and you just have to do it, and you have to do what you're told anyway. And that's basically what you're being trained to do. And that's how they know people are getting better, even though no one's doing drugs. When people are able to make that transition from what they needed to do to survive as part of street life in order to survive as part of the low-wage formal labor economy. And a lot of the drug dealers themselves, actually, who many of whom have a very strong work ethic already, have no problem with delayed gratification or anything like that. A lot of them found benefit in these types of programs, and they were able to sort of change the language that was being used, like, oh, I didn't have a drug problem, but I was addicted to money and I was pursuing money. You know, but people who are really interested in becoming part of, quote, respectable society and leaving the street economy behind and making that move into what they hope will not be the lowest level of the formal economy, but making that move into the formal economy, people who are interested in doing that often felt that they were able to benefit and to make use of these, quote, skills of being yelled at and taking it. You know, but some people might have had a real problem with anger. On the other hand, you know, some people, like one person I spoke with, she, you know, police would stop her and she would get very angry and even violent with the police and end up in jail because she would assault a police officer. And, you know, she felt like she was able to benefit from the types of instruction that she was receiving and conditioning that she was receiving at the treatment center. So some people are really able to make use of this. Particularly people that are interested in joining, quote, respectable society, making the transition from a street economy to formal labor. And the people that I felt like that was true of the most were either people who had just moved into the street economy and they were sort of shocked by what they had discovered there and they were freaking out and they were happy to have any route out of that street economy. Or alternatively, people who were sort of aging out of the street economy and had been doing it for a long time with, you know, enough success, but now they were getting older and they were having a hard time maintaining their position within the street economy. And they were looking for a way out. The people going through treatment who this just didn't make any sense for were a couple of different groups, but the main group was people who were in the street economy who felt like they were doing okay as part of that and had no interest in being part of certainly the lower tiers of the formal economy. And they just would go through the motions and do what they could. And for them, often treatment was, like I said before, an easier way to do their time than jail. Most of the people I spoke with a few exceptions, felt that the treatment centers, even as they were turning into mini jails, were a little bit better, at least, than the actual jails. So it was an easier way to do their time, if nothing else. But again, with some risk, that half of the people are going to fail and are going to end up in jail or prison anyway, and for an even longer time than if they hadn't tried. So, you know, this focus on the, quote, drugs lifestyle, really I felt like was a way of using psychiatry in order to treat what is a social issue, a social problem that basically has to do with forms of racialized poverty that exist in our society. And this was a way of using psychiatry to try to manage and control groups that have been largely excluded from our society and kept at the very margins, and basically was a form of racialized poverty management in the end.
That was from my conversation with Professor Kerwin Kay. Kay is an associate professor of sociology, American studies, and feminist, gender, and sexuality studies at Wesleyan University. He's the author of Enforcing Freedom, Drug Courts, Therapeutic Communities, and the Intimacies of the State. It's an excellent book. I recommend it highly. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh.
My name is Devin Reeves, and I'm the executive director of the Pennsylvania Harm Reduction Coalition, and we're a statewide, really, coalition of organizations and individuals that are looking to end the war on drugs and really help people overcome their struggle.
Tell us about yourself. How did you get involved in harm reduction?
Sure. So, I'm a person in recovery, and for me, that means that due to an abundance of access to resources, I was able to get and more when I was looking for help back in the summer of 2007. Through my recovery journey, I went back to school and got a degree in human services. I got a master's in social work at the University of Pennsylvania. And I've worked in the behavioral health industry for about, 10 years, most of that in direct service. And after a while, I got pretty disenchanted with the way treatment is delivered and how the dogma of 12 steps and the way things have always been was really hurting people and killing my friends. And I decided to start the Pennsylvania Harm Reduction Coalition because I'd already done some advocacy work. I was involved with expanding access to naloxone and 911 good Samaritan policies, which allows people to call 911 when their friends overdose things. And I just wanted to do more of that work, and we got some funding. We were able to pull it off, and it's been an exciting 2 years. We just passed the 2-year mark.
That's terrific. And I think it's interesting because you've got the lived experience background, which a lot of people involved in recovery have, but you've also got the academic background, which is how do you think that the two complement each other in the work that you do?
Well, I think, my current position gives me an opportunity to really lift up other people who are closer to the academic, at the kind of what's happening on the ground, make sure their voices are heard. So, a solid example is the House put together a resolution to study, best practices around warm handoff in the state of Pennsylvania. And, when I was in the room for my first meeting, I was saying, it's great that we have ER doctors and nurses and administrators and all these fancy people, and we really need to be talking to some people that are, using drugs right now, people that are likely to engage in a warm handoff program, people that have recently gone through a warm handoff program, because, we are the deliverers of the service, not the consumer of the services, right? So, I spent a lot of time learning from people that came from the mental health advocacy side, and that was very much driven by consumers, right? And we see oftentimes, or the general public sees people who use drugs, the consumers of services, as, shady, unreliable, not experts in their own lived experience. And we really want to, kind of flip that all on its head. And the academic side really gives me the ability to say, well, this is what the research says. It's not radical. Intervention X has worked for 30 years in America or across the planet. So, I really try to, I think about my experience in this field as really threefold. One, my academic, having a master's degree from a fancy school. Two, my years of kind of boots on the ground delivering direct services, as well as years on the ground, like going to town halls, being in the community, really being plugged in what's happening in the state of Pennsylvania. And then, of course, the third part is, somebody that used drugs in really a chaotic way for almost a decade.
The Pennsylvania Harm Reduction Coalition. Could you tell us a bit about that and some of the campaigns that you're working on?
Sure. So we see across the country that the way states and communities are responding to the overdose epidemic has changed, and we're really excited about that. But it falls into the very old social service kind of dichotomy of deserving versus undeserving. In our society, we see some people as very deserving of social services, and we see other people as less deserving. So, in our country, the people that are most deserving are our veterans, right? They wrote a blank check up to and including their lives just to protect our country. And oftentimes, veterans do not get the services they need, right? And the least deserving are, like, the old black men under the bridge, panhandling, asking for, you know, a nickel, with a, possibly with a, you know, a brown paper bag or some kind of bottle. And we tell him as a society, you know, pick yourself up by your bootstraps, so on and so forth. And so a lot of our responses to the overdose epidemic have fallen into that same kind of stratification where, you know, we say, you know, the kid from the suburbs who had a drug problem deserves to go to treatment. But the, you know, people of low socioeconomic status, people who have a history of criminal justice, well, they're going to go to jail, and maybe they'll get treatment, in air quotes, in jail. And so we focus on people that are most likely to experience an overdose and are most marginalized by the community, because we can build a system that helps them, it's going to help everybody. So the three populations that are most likely to experience an overdose are, number one, people that are getting out of jail. We know that people that are getting out of jail experience overdoses at 40 to 120 times the general public. So we're working on the state and the local level to expand access to medications for opioid use disorder for those leaving prisons, as well as blocks on distribution for the people leaving jails and prisons. And that's our Serving Returning Citizens campaign. Our second campaign is our Treatment Overdose Prevention campaign. Unlike people who are leaving prison, people who leave in treatment are also at an increased risk of overdose death. Anybody who's been abstinent from opioids for a long period of time is at increased risk of overdose death. And a lot of that has to do with we're not giving them the information on how to mitigate that risk. We're not telling them, hey, were you using five bags before? You've been abstinent for a period of time. If you go back to five bags, it's likely to kill you. We're not utilizing opioid agonist treatments like methadone and Suboxone inside of our treatment centers. So we're trying to expand information about avoiding overdose, expand utilization of medications for opioid use disorder, and we're also trying to get treatment centers to be giving naloxone to a patient and a loved one as they get ready to discharge. And our kind of last big campaign is our PASS campaign, the Pennsylvania Syringe Service campaign, and that is around people that are using drugs right now, right? And if we look back to what I said earlier about, you know, we give the deserving versus the undeserving, we give a lot of naloxone in the state of Pennsylvania to quote-unquote first responders, cops, EMTs, and we want them to have naloxone. However, the people that are most likely to have naloxone to witness an overdose or reverse an overdose are people that are using drugs. And we distribute more naloxone to people that are using drugs than anybody else really, you know, in the state. And we want to expand syringe service programs because that's the best way to interact with people that are using drugs right now. So we're working, again, on local community and the state level to expand access to syringe service programs.
Now, Philadelphia is probably closer than any other city in the U.S. to establishing the nation's first legally authorized supervised consumption facility. Safe House, which is a Philly nonprofit, won its first round of court battles against the feds late last year. Which I realize that Safe House is not PAHRC, but could you tell our listeners a little bit about supervised consumption facilities and reasons why municipalities should be allowed to legally authorize them?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's compare really quick supervised consumption facilities with syringe service programs. Syringe service programs are programs where people can get sterile syringes, information about avoiding overdose, testing for HIV, hepatitis C, connection to treatment. We know that people that engage in syringe service programs are five times more likely to enter treatment, you know, much more likely to stop injecting drugs, and really begin their journey to wellness. And that is an intervention that we have known for 30 years has worked really effectively on many different markers of success. The problem with that intervention is we give something everybody, you know, something people need to keep themselves well, their community well, the people that use drugs with well, and then we say, go shoot up in the out, and then they die. And a supervised consumption facility takes it one step further and says, if you're going to use drugs, please don't do it alone. Do it here in this clean, safe space, and we're going to have recovery coaches, nurses, doctors right here to help. And that is why we need them, because far too many people are in the uptick.
Last week, the National Academies of Science, Medicine, and Engineering issued a new report on opioid use disorder and infectious diseases. Among their recommendations, they called for the federal ban on funding for syringes by syringe service programs. They called for the federal ban to be lifted. Do you agree with that?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think it is 2020, and it's time to get politics out of science. We know that syringe service programs, you know, save money, and we live in trying times. You know, the rate of endocarditis, which is a disease linked to unsterile injecting practices, have more than doubled, and they cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to fix, and the untold cost of the loss of life when somebody dies from that, heart disease, hepatitis C, HIV, all of these diseases are 100% preventable, cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to fix, when a simple syringe that costs 8 cents could fix that. I mean, it's the right thing to do from a humanitarian perspective. It's the Christian thing to do, but it's also the fiscally responsible thing to do. You know, no party that claims we want to be the party that's about keeping our money straight as a country can vote this. No party that says we care about access to health care, we care about marginalized populations, can say we oppose this. And yet, it's an issue that's not discussed enough.
I recall, gosh, it was way back in 2007 at a methamphetamine conference in Salt Lake City. That was actually a point of contention. Dave Purchase, of all people, was arguing that the federal ban, you know, no big deal. No federal ban means no federal strings. And well, you know, that was that's one perspective. But
I as somebody that has worked on federally funded projects, they are onerous, often to the point where it's not worth doing the service. However, you know, just here in Pennsylvania, we've got people who are living, you know, almost in working poverty, that are working with a population that nobody else is able to reach. And that's not right. We shouldn't just have to rely on people's charity and philanthropic dollars for this totally rational, evidence-based public health intervention, right? In other spaces, whether it's the flu vaccine, hepatitis A vaccines, if there's a public health concern, we see public dollars fueling that intervention. However, people who use drugs are highly discriminated against, what some people like to call stigmatized, and therefore we don't give them the best scientific intervention. And we see this on many levels, whether it's how people who overdose are treated in the hospital, treatment centers refusing to use kind of the gold standard of medications for opioid use disorder. It's really... It's a travesty, and it's causing far too many people to lose their lives.
What should activists be doing in our communities and at the legislatures to encourage support and funding for harm reduction programs?
Sure. You know, I think that, you know, wherever you live at, there is a harm reduction organization, or hopefully there's a harm reduction organization in your community, and they're going to know what's best on how to get involved. And I reach out to them. You know, the Pennsylvania Harm Reduction Coalition has sister organizations all over the country that, you know, we're not financially tied together, whether it's, you know, the Iowa Harm Reduction Coalition, the National Harm Reduction Coalition, the Baltimore Harm Reduction Coalition, Suicide Prevention Works out of Arizona. They're all doing really good work. And, you know, any of your listeners are passionate about this project, reach out, get involved. And let's say that you live in a place where there is, you know, no organized effort. You know, become an engaged citizen. Reach out to your state legislator, your state senators, your state representatives, and say, hey, this is something I think we should be tackling. You know, go onto the CDC website. The CDC has great resources about how awesome syringe service programs are, how they keep our law enforcement community safer by decreasing needle sticks, how they reduce litter in the community, and they prevent disease and save people's lives. Print that out and go talk to your legislator. Hey, this is what the CDC thinks. Why aren't we tackling this in our state? You know, there there's something like 12, 15 states in our country that don't have, you know, statewide access to syringe service programs, and that's just wrong.
One of the things that we that everybody runs into is, you know, the not in my backyard types, the NIMBYs. Sure, I agree, all this is terrible. Oh, yes, I feel bad, but I don't want it within 1,000 yards of my home or my neighborhood. How do we deal with people like that?
You know, I don't know how to make people care about other people. You know, I think that one of the biggest things we can do is get out and talk about that this is in our community. You know, I can't tell you how many obituaries I've seen where a young person died suddenly. And that's code for they overdosed far too many times. And we need to stop hiding in shame. There is no shame around having a mental health diagnosis. I mean, even if we look at the Grammys last night, you know, there was a tribute to Prince, you know, this magnificent artist who died of an opioid overdose, right? And then Demi Lovato talked about her struggles overcoming her problems with drugs. This is everyday Americans' problem. It is not over there. It's not far away. It's not in our urban centers. It's right here. It's on the TV. It's in our neighborhoods. It's for far too many people. It's in our homes. We need to start embracing the science if we want to beat this.
You do a lot of really great work, you and the Pennsylvania Harm Reduction Coalition. How can people get in touch? You got a website. Give me your web address and social media.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, if you like funny memes and clips, please check us out on Twitter and Instagram. It's at PA Harm Reduction. I'm also on both platforms. I'm a little bit faster on both those platforms. My personal handle is at Devin_Reeves. And if you want to check us out on the web, it's paharmreduction.org. A lot of great resources there.
Terrific. Now, any closing thoughts for my listeners? And once again, folks, we are speaking with Devin Reeves. He's the Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Harm Reduction Coalition, based out in Philadelphia.
Absolutely. You know, with the election coming up, I encourage everybody to ask elected officials, leaders in their community, what they're doing to address the overdose epidemic. And it's not just about opioids, because we're seeing overdoses linked to methamphetamines going through the roof. If we're not talking to legislators and letting them know that's something that we care about as constituents, they're not going to care about it. Or they're not going to care about it to the level that's needed. Please get involved civically, get engaged, get out there and vote. That's how you make your voice heard.
Devin Reeves, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me on. I appreciate the opportunity.
It's a pleasure. Again, folks, we've been speaking with Devin Reeves, Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Harm Reduction Coalition. You can find them on the web at paharmreduction.org. That was my interview with Devin Reeves, Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Harm Reduction Coalition. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network, on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
The executive producer of the Drug Truth Network is Dean Becker. The Drug Truth Network has a Facebook page. Please give it a like. Drug War Facts is on Facebook, too. Give its page a like and share it with friends. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh, and of course also at Drug Policy Facts. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.